Every October since 1996, independent media activists across Canada have marked Media Democracy Day. Their goal is to highlight the concentration of media ownership in Canada in fewer and fewer hands. It also provides a time to both celebrate and reflect on independent media in Canada. Anna Leventhal is a graduate student at McGill University in Montreal. She also hosts the feminist music show Venus on Montreal's CKUT 90.3 FM. Leventhal spoke at McGill University to mark Media Democracy Day 2008 at an event organized by CKUT. In her talk, Leventhal reflects on her experience curating Quebec Alternatif, a collection of alternative Quebec print media from the late 1960s and 1970s, taken from the collection of McGill Communications professor Marc Raboy. In particular, Leventhal digs into how we learn from the media that came before us, and how we continue to build upon it today.
This talk is called Roots of Grass, which, to be honest, doesn't really mean anything. I mean, I just needed the title for the poster, and I thought it sounded good and made me think of Walt Whitman. But a better title would be The Long Memory. So this is a quote from Utah Phillips, who is a folk singer, obviously very well loved among some people here. Folk singer, labor organizer, and also kind of a grassroots historian, in that he just went around and talked to people. He talked to labor organizers, he talked to bums, he talked to working people. And somewhere along the way he said something along the lines of, the most radical idea in the world is the long memory. And his idea was basically that, like, there were so many generations of people who had done so much work organizing in the community, and yet a lot of that was getting lost. What's radical about the idea of the long memory is that if we didn't have to constantly be reinventing ourselves, our work could be that much more effective. But the thing about grassroots media is that its history is very fragmented, and so it's constantly reinventing itself. Even though the history of Quebec alternative media is not that long ago, it's something that, you know, really doesn't get talked about because we don't have so much access to these ideas. So I want to introduce another quote that addresses the same problem from a different angle. I kind of like to work this quote into everything I talk about because it's one of my favorite quotes. I think it's really important and also extremely moving. It's from a guy named Michael Warner, who's a scholar, and in this case he's writing about the relationship between AIDS activism and what I'll call queer memory. One reason why we have not learned more from the history of AIDS activism is that queers do not have the institutions for common memory and generational transmission around which straight culture is built. Every new wave of queer youth picks up something from its predecessors, but also invents itself from scratch. Many are convinced that they have nothing to learn from old dykes and clones and trolls, and no institutions, neither households, nor schools, nor political groups, ensure that this will happen. And since the most painfully instructed generation has been decimated by death, the queer culture of the present faces more than the usual shortfall in memory. Now younger queers are told all too often that a principled defense of non-normative sex is just a relic of bygone liberationism. This story is given out in bland confidence, since so many of the people who would have contradicted it have died. So, what does AIDS activism have to do with grassroots media? Like, what is Warner talking about here? What's the parallel? Well, I think the parallel is that, like queer activism, grassroots media has no institutional or archival infrastructure. You can't just, you know, go and reach into the archives of community radio and pull out a show from 30 years ago. It just doesn't exist. A lot of this stuff just really gets lost in the air. And this, you know, relates back to what Utah Phillips was saying about the long memory constantly being chopped up, so that we don't have this sense of a movement that's building on itself, but rather that we're constantly reinventing everything. I mean, I'm not necessarily arguing that we need to have improved archival practices here. I mean, it would be nice. It would be nice to have that archive that we could just reach into. But as media activists, we have a limited, finite set of resources at our disposal, time being one of those things, and also funding. So we have to make decisions about what we're going to focus on, and most of those decisions we make on the fly, provisionally, to deal with immediate issues. So I'm basically trying to make the point that while it's kind of interesting that grassroots media has to continually build itself from scratch, and maybe that's why it's powerful, because it never really gets the chance to become overly bureaucratic or institutionalized, at the same time we're always going to be telling grassroots history in improvisational, provisional ways. When Utah Phillips was talking about the union organizers, he said that they had done everything right and everything wrong in their organizational tactics. And if we could only access that knowledge, it would make things that much easier. And I mean, in the same way, the people who are behind these publications that I'm going to talk about have done everything right and everything wrong. But we're not really likely to learn from it. and we who work in grassroots media are going to keep making those same mistakes over and over because we don't have access to grassroots history, even if that history is only a generation away. So, I mean, it's a problem, and I'm not here to present a solution to that problem, except that in some sense, what we're doing here is, you know, digging a little bit into grassroots history. So the scene was Quebec after the 1960s, and as probably most everyone knows, the 1960s were a really kind of heady time for community activism and citizen mobilization. I mean, there were race riots, there was, you know, a lot of citizen movements. Paris, 1968, I mean, I'm sure we can think of all sorts of examples. There was this very strong feeling amongst the people in general that, you know, it was very important to be taking media into people's own hands and telling their own stories. You know, there were just like all these uprisings, revolutions, marches, riots, and so on. And of course, in Quebec, Quebec was just kind of coming out of the long slumber of the Duplessis years, and people were really beginning to try to make real, I mean, not just political change, but real cultural and social change. And it was a very, as I said, I can't think of a better word, but it was very heady times. And basically what happened was that there was this kind of happy collision of angry citizenry and accessible print technology. So in the 1970s, print culture in Quebec really exploded. There were just, you know, so many newspapers, magazines, community-oriented kind of stuff being printed. But it wasn't just that people were sort of like having this this surface image for their dissent. It wasn't just sort of dissent being made manifest. It was actually like a lot of these publications are interesting because they were really channels of communication. They were pedagogical tools. They were ways that people figured out theories amongst each other. People disagreed with each other, argued with each other, and basically formed communities and networks with and through these publications. Of course, I mean, by comparison, the larger climate of mainstream media basically allows for a single hegemonic viewpoint, one which was perceived to be usually in line with ruling party and commercial interests. But conversely, these publications made room for internal debate, and dispute and criticism were an essential part of the mandate. I mean, half these publications flopped because their editorial boards couldn't stop fighting with each other, which I actually think is really interesting, that they weren't so much about presenting this unified front that everybody could, you know, or that they wanted everyone to agree with, but that it was really all about argument and discussion. So the other side of this coin is that because there was this kind of very, you know, I'll say it again, grassroots movement, a lot of these publications were made very cheaply. They had the present in mind and not the future. They were printed on, you know, cheap newsprint, which becomes yellow and brittle. They didn't use archival ink, so the ink fades. You know, they fall apart really easily. They were designed with economy in mind rather than beauty. Although I think that in retrospect, they actually have a really appealing look. And I especially love this one, En Lutte, which means basically in struggle. So, I mean, I think that we have this tendency to value things that last a long time. You know, we'll say this newspaper's been around for 50 years, therefore it must be really good. But I think that this is not necessarily the best way to look at things, and that I think we kind of have to make room for thinking about things and like looking at things that no longer exist and that failed, and you know, why did they fail and what did they achieve while they were around? Because I mean, sometimes things come up to deal with immediate issues. Maybe they don't last decades and decades, but they still serve an important purpose in their community. So how else did these things differ from mainstream media? Well, I think as a good illustrative example, we could look at what happened during the October crisis. If independent media ever needed a reason to believe in its own importance, the October crisis was kind of what crystallized it for these publications. I mean, it was really the defining moment of the 1970s in Quebec. And I mean, you could argue it's still very relevant today. So basically, it began with the FLQ, which is the Front de Libération de Québec, which was sort of a radical separatist group, kidnapped James Cross and Pierre Laporte, who were two members of the government who they saw as really kind of representing English Canada and its dominance over the Québécois. And shortly after this, I mean, it all happened within 2 weeks. It was a very intense period. So shortly after that, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau implemented the War Measures Act, which basically meant that Quebec was under martial law. This was peacetime, mind you. This wasn't during an actual war, but it was as though there was, you know, under the War Measures Act, that meant that anyone could be, they could arrest anyone who they suspected of being a sympathizer with the FLQ without proof. They sort of suspended habeas corpus. So they could, basically hundreds of people were arrested and detained without any real reason, including union leaders, activists. I mean, if it happened now, we'd probably all be in jail. Pierre Laporte, one of the men who was kidnapped, was murdered by the FLQ during this period. And obviously, you know, this was a very intense time. And basically, if you look at all the mainstream media outlets in Quebec, they were all kind of talking about the terrorist activities in the terrorist cells. And I mean, I'm not saying that they weren't terrorists. I mean, they were using terror tactics. But the small-scale publications were basically the only place where you could get any kind of, like, real discussion, real variety. I mean, they were talking to people who were detained, they felt without cause, people who did prison time because of the War Measures Act. I mean, it was basically, like, the ramifications from the October Crisis continued. I mean, I just chose Our Generation as one example of a publication that was dealing with the October Crisis and its fallout. So it was just kind of a way of, a way for you know, various activist groups in Quebec to think about their relationship with the state and with the police. So they were basically one of the only places where you could find dissenting, varying views. So I'll talk a little bit more specifically about where these publications came from and what they did. A lot of them came from working class Quebecois who really felt themselves to be struggling against capitalism, which was seen as synonymous with English Canada. So, you know, these were factory workers, union organizers, laborers, and also Marxist-Leninist thinkers. And these papers, I mean, I think we sort of tend to think of media nowadays as, like, people telling their stories, which is interesting and important. But at the same time, I mean, that wasn't really what was going on here. It wasn't so much, at least in this case, it wasn't so much a matter of these people wanting to, you know, express themselves as really, like, the papers they published were really pedagogical tools. They were ways of thinking about how to apply Marxist theories to their current situation in Quebec. And they did this not just through meeting and discussing, but through these publications, through writing and discussing it in this sort of public forum of the publications. They weren't just reporting on their activities through the papers, they were actually getting things done. These papers were tools. So Quebec Press began in 1969 as a national popular publication. It was supported by a variety of trade unions, popular groups, and co-ops. According to its mission statement, it was, this is a quote, "the people's response to the domination of the press by cultural, political, or economic dictatorship." It was the first newspaper in Quebec to publish the manifesto of the FLQ. And because of its radical stance, it was boycotted by advertisers, businesses, and public institutions. There's a couple here that I'm going to talk about, which is Point de Mire, this red one here, and then in the middle, Bulletin Populaire. They also maintained radical socialist and nationalist attitudes, often drawing critical and repressive forces from outside. In 1972, the RCMP, in collaboration with Montreal and Quebec police forces, actually broke into the Bulletin Populaire offices and stole over 1,000 files. In 1970, three Radio Canada journalists were threatened with dismissal if they continued to write and publish in Point de Mire. One of them was eventually fired. The Front de Libération Populaire, also known as FLP, was a semi-clandestine radical group, and it had its print organ in Mobilisation, which you can see on the left there with those kind of angry fist-shaking people. Mobilisation was a Marxist-Leninist monthly review dedicated to organizing the working classes. The FLP also published La Masse, which you can see here, along with En Lutte. En Lutte was a proletarian publication with a similarly orthodox Leninist approach. It also criticized union leadership, and it encouraged a more centralized political approach, which kind of set it apart from the majority of Quebec's leftist political philosophy. There were also some publications that had kind of a more specific intent. There were these neighborhood publications, like we saw earlier, the Saint-Louis Sud, Le Va-Vite, L'Avenir, and then which were intended to strengthen a sense of community among their readership and encourage residents to take action in their own locales. On the left there, we see one called Up to the Neck, which was, I guess, something that today we would call a zine. The terminology wasn't really around at the time, or at least not that popular, but it was basically done in response to housing crises in Quebec. So it was, and there were also like instructional booklets on how to like protest rent, illegal rent increases by your landlord, something which people today would probably find very relevant. There was a small publishing house called Les Éditions Québécois, which produced pedagogical and theoretical texts with simple, accessible designs and clear writing, such as there's one called Pourquoi une révolution au Québec? And then they also had a socio-historical series called Les gens du Québec. So this one focused on Saint-Henri, which is a traditionally working-class neighborhood in Montreal, where a lot of the factory workers would have come from. Occasionally, Les Éditions Québécois got a little bit lighter and more humorous. And, like, for instance, they published this book in the middle, which is called Recettes pour chômeurs et grévistes, which is, like, recipes for people on welfare and people on strike. And it was actually, it's an actual recipe book, and there's recipes inside, like, potage économique and paella du pauvre, poor people's paella, or cheap soup, or whatever. So it's just, like, these, you know, how to cook for yourself and your family on very little income. Now, I don't want to give the impression that everything that was being produced at the time was so orthodox. I mean, I think right now anyone who's involved in any kind of like lefty activist circles knows that there's kind of this split between a very orthodox, organized, dogmatic side that's really arguing their main focus is class struggle, and then there's this kind of other side that's really interested in cultural politics and identity politics, and never the twain shall meet. And the split is possibly even stronger today, but it existed then as well. So there were different groups and publications that approached egalitarian struggles on a more personal and slightly more entertaining level. So this is Quartier Latin, which began as the Université de Montréal student newspaper, but kind of grew into its own publication. It was criticized for being somewhat unfocused and naive in its political approach, but it was definitely very lively. It's definitely one of my favorite publications in this collection. It's like, I could actually like barely understand what it was talking about half the time because it just like approached things almost like a collage, like it was very kind of experimental. It seemed to draw from sort of like the 1960s psychedelia, surrealist collage, 1940s letterism. Here's one inside view. I don't know if you can read that, but it says fuckorium. Don't really know what that means, but really beautiful drawings. And so it was approaching political problems, but it was doing them kind of obliquely, which I find is really interesting. It was less a journal than kind of a roundup of various energetic approaches to student activism, but it does paint a vivid picture of the radical student movement and the vitality of Montreal's youth culture of the period. So here's Le Temps Fou. It was launched in 1978 by a few people who had worked on Bulletin Populaire and Quebec Press, those two publications we saw earlier, but they wanted to see a publication with broader public appeal and an approach more attuned to Quebec's burgeoning cultural revolution. So there was Le Temps Fou and then also its sort of sister magazine, La Vie en Rose. They chronicled a progressive cultural movement that was also anti-authoritarian with anarchist leanings, and therefore sometimes not really commensurable with the more dogmatic socialist, Marxist-Leninist, or class struggle-based movements and publications. These two magazines were also decidedly feminist, and it's really amazing to look through them because it's like, I see almost nothing like them today. They were really doing stuff. I mean, I would describe them as queer, but I mean kind of queer in the modern sense, in that they approach sexuality in a very sort of like non-normative sense. The Vie en Rose usually had, they had sort of like a naughty centerfold in most of the issues, which was illustrated. And the one, I think it's in this one, I'm not sure, but it's sort of like this sexualized nativity scene. I won't go into too much detail, but it's like quite dirty and funny also. And you know, if you think about Quebec as being this, you know, having this long history of Catholic repression, and then it's like you see this drawing and it's like, whoa, they were really out there. So these two publications took as basic the feminist idea that the personal is political, and they investigated identity politics and cultural development with as much dedication as nuclear disarmament and the machinations of various political parties, which they were also interested in. According to Marxist-Leninist doctrine, basically like women's liberation is an important factor in class revolt, but these magazines instead approach it as being like talking about the struggles of individual Quebecois women that they face in their everyday lives, not just as laborers or oppressed homemakers, but as artists, activists, writers, wage earners, breadwinners, and sex workers. yeah, I really can't say enough about these two magazines. I really think that they're worth revisiting because they were really doing something that was extremely original for the time and would still be original and very welcome today. It was feminist consciousness that brought public health to the forefront. And this is evidence of the push towards greater access to health information. So there was a series called Medicine for the People. There was one that was about what was called VD back then, venereal diseases, which I guess today would be STDs. And then, what's that other one up top there? Birth Control Handbook, yeah. So these were publications that were printed very cheaply and distributed for free by these women's health collectives. And they also created Women in the Law in Quebec, you know, like, what are your rights when you're in an abusive relationship? Stuff like this that women wouldn't necessarily have access to. So they were really putting it out there. It wasn't all French either. English Quebec's representation in the 1970s print culture was smaller in volume, but no less notable. Our Generation was a journal published by Black Rose Books, which is actually still operational. It's an anarchist publisher based in Montreal. It was one of Canada's longest-running alternative journals. It was originally titled Our Generation Against Nuclear War, and it began as being a strictly pro-disarmament publication, but it grew considerably to encompass a variety of causes and discussions. It was especially notable for being dedicated to exploring the idea of nonviolent revolution and its manifestations through participatory democracy and institutional change. It also had a very strong interest in ecology and urban studies. I mean, it was very ahead of its time. I mean, you know, the whole idea of like going green seems like it was just invented yesterday, but really, I mean, it's been around for a very long time. And these magazines or this journal was pushing very hard for thinking about the environment and the city in relationship with each other. It published people like Murray Bookchin, who's also the one who named Black Rose Books, Stuart Hall, Malcolm Caldwell, and Noam Chomsky, who some of you may have heard of. The Last Post was another publication that eventually ended up in Toronto, but it was founded in Montreal, and it had a strong interest in solidarity with the Quebec left. It was the first periodical to publish segments of Pierre Valier's seminal and incendiary book, White Niggers of America, which was written while the author was imprisoned in the late 1960s as a result of his participation with the FLQ. As you can imagine, the title alone is very sort of, incendiary, as I said. So I'm just going to tell you about one more publication as kind of a last example of Quebec's reputation for progressive approach to publishing. And this is a publication that actually wasn't even from Quebec. There was a magazine called Scanlan's Monthly. I think it made it to issue 2, maybe. And it was a very radical American political muckraking magazine. It became unpopular very quickly among politicians and trade unions alike. So the second issue they published was about guerrilla warfare. It was called Guerrilla Warfare, and it chronicled radical groups in the U.S. like the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers. So this issue of Scanlan's was turned away by every large-scale printing press in the United States, either for fear of government reprisal or because the issue openly criticized union leaders, many of whom, of course, were closely tied to the print industry. They just didn't want to risk publishing this because they figured it meant death for them, you know, literally or figuratively. So finally, the second issue of Scanlan's came to light through a press in Saint-Jean, Quebec, so they eventually had to send it over the border to get it printed. At the time, this was during, while Quebec was under martial law, because of the October crisis, the province nevertheless seemed to have a more liberal attitude towards freedom of the press than its southern neighbor. And, I mean, I don't know if it's entirely accurate, but the Scanlan's affair certainly suggested an image of Quebec as a bastion of free speech, progressive attitudes, and unmitigated self-expression. If you read the editorial notes of the second Scanlan's, they're just kind of like lauding Quebec as this place where anything can get published and anyone can say anything. I mean, I don't know if it's entirely true, but like it was really this very strong idea that, you know, the left had very strong support here amongst publishers and just kind of like broad popular support. So just to bring this up to the present a little bit, I think that today we probably have access to more forms of media technology than we've ever had. I mean, at this time, you know, we're talking about things like having access to photocopiers and printing presses. And I mean, now we have so much more. Like everyone has potential to make their own radio show or their own desktop publication. So, I mean, in a sense, we're poised on the brink of something. But at the same time, I think that it kind of remains to be seen whether or not it's actually going to coalesce into some really meaningful revolution, or whether it's going to, like, spiral off into some kind of evolutionary backwater where we're all just, you know, fiddling with our iPods and checking Facebook all day. I don't think that it takes a lot to change things. Just to go back to the example that I gave with Michael Warner's quote about AIDS activism, basically everything that we have today in terms of AIDS education came from gay men and their allies and their activism in the 80s and 90s. When people first started dying of AIDS in the 80s, no one really cared, quite honestly. The only people that cared, I mean, the people who were dying were gay men and drug users, and, you know, no one was very concerned. So it was mainly gay men and their allies, who were mostly lesbians, who formed groups like ACT UP and really brought the public's attention to what was really a huge health crisis. And I mean, how many of them were there? You know, like maybe 1,000 spread over several large cities? And yet they basically created the idea of safe sex and thought about how to implement it in their communities. And much of our current educational model is based on their activism. So that's just like one example of how a small dedicated group of people can make a huge difference. So, I mean, that's just something to think about in terms of, you know, how people can use technology. I mean, just like in light of Media Democracy Day, I mean, it's not just, technology isn't just this kind of like objective thing that comes along and is plopped down in front of us. It basically like results from a set of socially enabling institutions and infrastructure. So how it gets used is, you know, really going to be contingent on people being organized and mobilized.
This week on the Citizen Shift podcast, you heard Anna Leventhal with her talk, Roots of Grass. Roots of Grass was presented by CKUT Radio. For more on CKUT, visit www.ckut.ca. To learn more about Media Democracy Day, visit www.mediademocracyday.org.
To hear more or submit your own podcast, visit thecitizen.nfb.ca. To receive our latest podcasts, consider subscribing to our RSS feed.